Well, good morning, TNC family. 12 days before Christmas. 11 days before our Christmas Eve Zoom communion service, and 3 days after I delivered hundreds of toys from each of you to our friends and partners at North Fulton Community Charities. True story, as I was loading up all the gifts into my vehicle, a police officer pulled into the church parking lot. Very curious about all the gifts leaving the church and going into my car. And he didn't accuse me, but I did make sure to assure him that this wasn't theft, but gift. And he told me to be careful, have a Merry Christmas, and make sure I could see out the back window because toys were packed in the trunk and from floorboard to ceiling in the back seat and the passenger seat. And it was truly a day last week that was awesome and fun and good. And now today's gonna be good too. So here we go, from my home to wherever you are, as we continue to remember, celebrate, and consider what it means to experience and live out the Christmas story in our day. And I want to start with this. I just finished reading last week a really fun book. Mind-bending and eye-opening, actually. Its title is one word, Deep, by James Nestor, who was fascinated by the sport of freediving, in which competitors descend to great depths in the ocean on a single breath, no scuba tank. And Nestor, who wrote the book, is a writer and a reporter who embeds himself with a group of freedivers and along the way learns about all kinds of things, whales who communicate with other whales hundreds of miles away, thousands of feet deep, and sharks that swim in straight lines through pitch black waters. But most fascinating and challenging and inspiring is he learns about what happens inside a human being when they are willing to both prepare to go deep and then, in fact, do go deep. Chapter 2, it's centered on the most famous free diver ever, New Zealander William Troubridge, who, using only his bare hands and feet, no fins, was preparing to break the record for how deep you could go on one breath. Troubridge was planning to go 331 feet down, which is longer than a football field, back end of the end zone to back end of the end zone. And at that depth, the pressure is more than 9 times that of the surface, strong enough to crush a Coke can. 330 feet down into the abyss of Dean's Blue Hole in the Bahamas. And back up to the surface on a single breath of air with a total dive time of 4 minutes and 10 seconds. And he succeeded, by the way, and actually shortly thereafter he broke his own record, diving to a depth of 407 feet and holding his breath for 4 minutes and 34 seconds. And it's fascinating because going down is actually the easy part, because after 70 feet, you lose your buoyancy and get pulled down quickly by gravity alone, which makes going up the hardest part, especially without fins, because you're actually pulling against gravity to force yourself to the surface. And Troubridge and free divers like him prepare for journeys like this by doing yoga-like poses and meditation exercises, and then, listen to this, by taking deep breaths. That's me taking deep breaths, actually gulping air, almost like taking huge bites of food, except it's bites of air, because for the free diver, he or she knows that they are about to go on a very demanding journey, into a situation that will be very tough, and so they need to bring as much with them to the journey as they can. Truebridge says, quote, "Free diving is as much a mental game as a physical one." And so for almost 20 minutes, Truebridge is just gulping breath after breath after breath, forcing his lungs open and filling them fuller and fuller, because at the deepest part of the ocean, there's so much pressure that by the time he gets to the bottom of his dive, the pressure will be crushing his lungs to the size of baseballs and reducing his heart rate to only 7 to 14 beats per minute, a heart rate that cannot support conscious life at the surface. So in advance, he's manually forcing them to become as big as a watermelon. Because the tougher the journey, the more strength you'll need. And the longer it takes, the more fuel you'll need. And the darker the path, the more focus you'll need. And in the book, Nestor learns about what happens inside a human being when they're willing to both prepare to go deep and then, in fact, do go deep. It gives them some of the strongest minds and bodies and perspectives of any humans alive, he says. And I say all of this, TNC, to say this. I think it's really important this Christmas that we rock around the Christmas tree. And I think it's important that we hang the holly and the ivy and the mistletoe. And I think it's important that we drink cider and eat gingerbread cookies and candy canes. These are good and important traditions. But it's also important that we are willing to go deep, to meditate on and take in deep breaths of the Christmas story, and to examine what it really says about reality, about the God of the universe that is billions of galaxies and 93 billion light years wide, about a divine force that cares for human beings and is willing to enter their time and space, and about the human condition and the longing and need for this story that we all share, and what the story says about peace and justice and beauty and truth. And so I want to go deep with you today and teach from the words of perhaps the greatest ancient prophet in all of history, the prophet Isaiah, the most quoted Old Testament prophet in the entire New Testament, and the prophet who described longings of the human heart in some of the most profound and deep ways, and who wrote 800 years before the birth of Jesus the Christ, in an era when the people of God were living in uncertain and threatening times, an era when people were asking, what is going on out there? And how in the world did we get here? And why are we so polarized? And why am I so worried and fearful? It was an era when, to the north, the Assyrian Empire was on the march, taking people into captivity by droves. To the east, the Babylonian Empire was expanding in its military and technological might. To the south and west, Egypt remained a world player. And squeezed in between all of this were 10 northern tribes of Israel and 2 southern tribes of Judah, living amid economic and social and political unrest. And about that time, a new royal prince was born in Jerusalem, evoking an oracle from the prophet Isaiah. An oracle, a prophecy, anticipating that with this birth would dawn a new age of well-being, peace, and prosperity, a season of great light in a world of darkness, a coming king that would release the people of God from oppression and usher in a new era of endless peace. Isaiah 9 and verse 2, listen. The people walking in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of the shadow of death, a light has dawned. Verse 3, You will enlarge the nation of Israel, and its people will rejoice. They will rejoice before you as people at the harvest, and like warriors dividing the plunder. For you will break the yoke of their slavery and lift the heavy burden from their shoulders. You will break the oppressor's rod, just as you did when you destroyed the army of Midian. For unto us a child is born, to us a son is given. The government will rest on his shoulders, and he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of his government and its peace there will be no end. He will rule with fairness and justice from the throne of his ancestor David for all eternity. And Isaiah's prophecy gave the people of God a hope that they so desperately needed, a child born to fulfill the covenant, a new David, who would bear the titles Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Now, it's very important that you listen carefully to this. In its historical context, Isaiah's oracle, his prophecy, is not a prediction of the distant future or a prediction of Jesus' Bethlehem birth 800 years later. Walter Brueggemann, probably the premier Old Testament scholar alive today, respected and cited by Jewish and Christian historians and theologians, writes about this oracle, quote, Isaiah's oracle did not anticipate or predict Jesus. There is no doubt that it pertained to the 8th century BCE, the time of Isaiah the prophet. It is an oracle used to announce and celebrate the birth of a new royal prince in Jerusalem, namely Hezekiah, or more probably to the coronation of another new king. And by the way, TNC, scholars from John Walton to N.T. Wright to Dale Allison to Marcus Borg and John Dominic Crossan all say some version of this. But listen, it turns out that Hezekiah's reign would not be that ideal reign spoken of in the oracle. And so the people of God would continue to long for the era when Messiah would come, when a new leader would help usher in a better era. And they still clung to that oracle. And so at the time of Jesus' birth, they were still waiting, still hoping for someone to fulfill the prophecy. Which leads us to Matthew and Luke, biographers of Jesus, who 800 years after Isaiah identify in Jesus this one who would fulfill Isaiah's oracle. Matthew chapter 4, verses 12 to 16. Listen, now when Jesus heard that John the Baptist had been arrested, he withdrew to Galilee. Leaving Nazareth, he made his home in Capernaum by the lake, in the territory of Zebulun and Naphtali, so that what had been spoken through the prophet Isaiah might be fulfilled. Matthew taking this directly from Isaiah 9, because Matthew wants us to see that in Jesus is the Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Only Matthew will make it clear that Jesus was a different kind of Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, and Prince of Peace. In fact, even deeper and more wonderful than Isaiah imagined, because Jesus fulfilled these titles in ways that surprised folks. And so I want to talk with you about these titles for a few minutes now and let them seep deep into our bones and into our hearts and into our vision for how we think about and live out these next 12 days and beyond into other seasons of life, seasons that can feel uncertain and risky, and to which you and I will need the strength of a wonderful counselor, mighty God, everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. So let's talk very briefly about each of these four royal Christmas titles. And the first title given to the one born in Bethlehem, the first Christmas title is Wonderful Counselor. Wonderful Counselor. A term that is not the same as, wow, I need a marriage and family therapist. And not the same as, I object, Your Honor, overruled. Counselors, approach the bench. No, the term counselor here, used by Isaiah and adopted by Matthew and Luke in their Christmas biographies, refers to how one administers and exercises influence. In ancient Israel, a counselor was a term for a wise king or an advisor to the king. In ancient Egyptian culture, pharaohs had super counselors called viziers. They both advised the pharaoh and helped carry out his policies. In the Roman Republic, the Caesar would have councils or counselors. Now, Isaiah adds a qualifying word for the Messiah counselor, and it's the word wonderful. In other words, it's not just someone who exercises influence, but it's someone who exercises influence wonderfully. And I would just propose to you here that when it comes to being in a relationship with someone who has influence over you, perhaps there's no more wonderful quality of that counselor than truth-telling. In the words of the writer of Proverbs chapter 24, an honest answer is like a kiss on the lips, because honesty produces some of the most welcome and amazing fruit in your life. First, let me just say quickly that honesty is the arena for safe and vulnerable relationships. I mean, very little is worse than not knowing if a person in your life can be trusted to tell you the truth. Like, I feel like you're looking out for yourself with that comment, with that policy. I wonder if you don't might not have a hidden agenda. I wonder if jealousy or hurt feelings are driving what you're telling me. I know you made a commitment, but I can't really count on you to follow through. I told you a secret, but I'm actually pretty worried that you're going to tell somebody else. And so no honesty from a counselor means no safety or vulnerability or trust or growth. Conversely, honesty is the area for maximum safety, vulnerability, and growth. Think about it. The best football player wants honesty from the head coach. It'll be great for the team. The best cook wants honesty from the master chef. It will be great for whoever partakes of the food. The best employee wants honesty from her boss. The best student wants honesty from her teachers. The best spouse wants honesty from his or her partner. Pick whatever you want to do well in life, friends, and you'll want to be influenced by someone who will lead you there with knowledge and honesty. Honesty is the arena for maximum growth. Now enter the wonderful counselor. And pay attention now to John's biography of Jesus, because John's favorite phrase to describe God's Spirit is the phrase, counselor. The Greek word is paraclete. And Jesus says in John over and over, including in John 16, that when the counselor comes, quote, he will guide you into all truth. That's the defining quality of the wonderful counselor, that he will guide you into all truth. And so this Christmas, we must know that at the heart of our Messiah is this truth. We can trust his words and his wisdom. and we can put his words into practice with confidence because we will find them to be true. He is a wonderful counselor. Number two, the second title given to the one born in Bethlehem, the second Christmas title is Mighty God. Mighty God, a term used by both Isaiah and Matthew to refer to one whose power transcends human power and authority. In other words, this isn't positional power. It's not, well, God's the quarterback and I'm the backup. He's the president and I'm the vice president. He's rich, I'm poor. He can bench press the entire world. I can only lift 100 pounds. His IQ is 250, mine's only 100. This isn't positional might, powering up, threatening lawsuits or violence or bossing people around. This isn't about what you have the right to do because of your position of might. Isaiah says, Matthew wants us to know, this is divine power, a power that the Apostle Paul will talk about this way in Ephesians chapter 1, when he says, quote, I pray that you will understand the incredible greatness of God's power for those of us who believe him. This is the same mighty power that raised Christ from the dead and seated him in the place of honor at God's right hand in the heavenly realms. Now he is far above any ruler or authority or power or leader or anything else, not only in this world, but also in the world to come. In other words, Paul says, it's a different kind of power. So, what kind of might, what kind of mighty God raised Christ from the dead? Well, it's a power that doesn't tear down, but instead heals. It's a power that doesn't stir up storms, but calms them. It's a power that, while hanging from a cross, forgives instead of curses. It's a might that defends the cause of the poor and gives relief to the needy and hope to the oppressed and chooses servanthood over being served and generosity over hoarding. Friends, listen, if you want to know what divine Christmas power is, then look around you in the next 12 days and notice the givers and the servers and the forgivers, the meek, the humble, the gentle, the ones who wash your feet and carry your burden an extra mile and turn the other cheek and do unto others as they'd want done to them. If you want to know what divine Christmas might is, look to a Bethlehem manger, because the mighty God demonstrates his might not through the elite Egyptians, the mighty Romans, the fierce Assyrians, or the golden Babylonians. Instead, it's through a small nation, rarely with power, at least not power as the world knows it, which should cause us to ask, why? Why? Why does over and over and over and over God say, I will choose Nazareth, I will choose a manger in Bethlehem, I will choose poor shepherds, I will choose a girl nobody wants, I'll choose the boy everybody has forgotten? Why? And go back further. And notice that God always wants to show his might and work through Abel, not Cain, Isaac, not Ishmael, Jacob, not Esau, through David, not his older brothers. And God chooses the older Sarai, not the younger Hagar. And he chooses Leah, not Rachel. He chooses Rebecca, who can't have children, Hannah, who can't have children, and Elizabeth, who can't have children. Why? Why? Is it just that God likes the underdogs? No. He's telling us something about real power and where real power comes from. Real power, he says, comes from unlikely places and in unlikely ways. Real power is a power that exhausts evil, not by using evil same ways, but rather by overcoming evil with good. And this Christmas, we must know that at the heart of our Messiah is a different kind of might. It's deeper, more revolutionary, characterized by love. Which leads us to the third title given to the one born in Bethlehem. The third Christmas title is Everlasting Father. And this is my favorite one because this title speaks of relationship. In a culture where the gods were distant and capricious and non-personal, this is a statement that the divine creator wants relationship with creation. That God is not an old lonely man on a throne. God is relationship, and God wants relationship. And the divine DNA is creator and creation in intimate relationship. It's why the Christmas Jesus is given the name Emmanuel, God with us. It's somehow that launched and highlighted through the Bethlehem story is that the divine presence is here. And not only over there in some far off distant realm, it's Everlasting Father, a divine parent who shares a home with us, who lives with us and protects and teaches and sacrifices and always sees the best and loves. And friends, that word love, I get it. It has lots of shades of meaning in our culture, but we should understand this. At its deepest and truest, love is all about relationship. It's about a God who wants to be with us and who wants to see us be with one another. It's about being drawn out of myself towards something or someone else. It's about discovering in fresh and new and deeper ways that I become more fully myself when I am in relationship. It's about knowing to the depth of my being that I need to be a part of something larger than myself, something that gives me a sense of warmth, security, meaning, delight, hope, peace, and coming home to the heart of an everlasting Father. And this Christmas, we must know that at the heart of our Messiah is a different kind of divinity, deeper, more revolutionary, characterized by relationship, an everlasting Father. Which leads us to the final title given to the one born in Bethlehem, the fourth Christmas title, and it's Prince of Peace. Peace, a rather elusive word in our day, I think, because there is a tendency to make Christmas peace primarily a privatized spiritual peace, peace of mind, rather than peace on earth. Yet when you read the scriptures, Christmas peace is almost always more about peace for the earth than it is peace of mind. Christmas peace, it turns out, is not about locked doors and warm blankets and life insurance, health insurance, car insurance, homeowners insurance, renters insurance, warranties, and money-back guarantees. It's an alternative vision for humanity centered around inclusion and embrace. It's about a peace that will come when a family finds safety as refugees in a foreign country. It's about angels interested in including marginalized shepherds. It's about sharing a stable if your inn has no vacancy. It's about welcoming wise men from the east and refusing to go along with power when power is corrupt, disguised as, oh, I want to go worship the baby. Christmas peace is about how I speak and listen, and where I sit, and who I invite, and sharing my 5 loaves and 2 fishes. These are the things that make for peace, the Messiah says. And this Christmas, we must know that at the heart of our Messiah is a different kind of peace. It's a peace characterized by sharing and inclusion and embrace. So, here we are, 12 days before Christmas, 20 centuries after Bethlehem. And the vision of the wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, and Prince of Peace remains the vision that we are called to follow in the days ahead. For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given. And it's a story, to borrow words from the psalmist in chapter 42 and verse 7. It's the story of deep calling to deep. Deep calls to deep, the psalmist says. In other words, it's not whistling in the dark or rocking around a Christmas tree. At least not just that. It's the wonderful Counselor who goes to work speaking truth in homes and neighborhoods and in cities and to systems of power and control and oppression. It's the Mighty God who demonstrates his might by walking through Galilee, feeding the hungry, healing the sick, rescuing people, and restoring creation itself. It's the Everlasting Father giving himself totally to this beloved world. It's watching Jesus from his earliest beginnings with a price on his head, all the way through to his riding the donkey into Jerusalem. It's watching Jesus, following him as he includes and embraces and shares and shows us what it looks like when the Prince of Peace is on the move. For Jesus modeled an alternative way, a deeper way, a truer way of seeing the world. Now, some will dismiss this as if it were irrelevant, or chalk up a talk like this to warm and fuzzy fiction. But the truth is that it is all too relevant for our day. It's the vision of real hope that the powers of our world do their best to quiet. But we TNC, we're gonna sing it and live it out loud today, tomorrow, until Christmas and beyond. So let's go deep. Let's pray. Oh God, to you, our wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, and Prince of Peace, we really do want to go deep with you this week. So will you create in us a pure heart and renew in us a steadfast spirit? Will you give us a spirit of grace and truth and humility and love and inclusion in everything we say and do? Amen.